Hello, I'm Alex Amon, your non-binary host, and this is the 59th episode of The Art of Asymmetrical Warfare. Today I'll talk about coming to Bonn during the Irish Civil War. But first, a small announcement. This will be the last episode of 2023. I realized, looking at the calendar, we're like a few weeks away from Christmas, so I decided to take a hiatus during the last 2 weeks in December. I hope to come back with a new episode on January 10th. And now it's time for the betting for money bit. If you enjoy this podcast, or my TikTok, or my blog, it would mean the world to me if you joined my Patreon, especially since it's the holiday season. And, you know, I like Christmas presents. I'd like to be able to produce this podcast full-time, and that's only going to be possible if I have your support. And if you join now, you might get a little Christmas present yourself. And now, time for making history. So first thing first, if you're in Chicago, Never Again Chicago is hosting a Legends, Latkes, and Liberation fundraiser event on Thursday, December 14th. They are fundraising for the Refugee Community Coalition, which is a mutual aid group here in Chicago helping refugees and immigrants. I'll place the RSVP link in the description. But if you can't attend, either because you're busy that day or you're not in Chicago, you can still make a donation to the Refugee Community Coalition. I will provide the donation link in the description as well. And now time to switch our attention back to Palestine, because it's always going to be Palestine at this point until we stop the genocide. So today is the global strike for Palestine. I know a lot of people are the only breadwinners for their families, they can't afford to lose their jobs, etc. But if you can, please go on strike today. Walk out of your place of employment and our school and join a picket line for Palestine. If you can't, and to be transparent, I'm one of those people who can't, you can still help by boosting the strike on your social media platforms, calling your representatives, continuing to boycott the companies on the BDS list. Make sure your friends are also boycotting those companies. If you have meetings today, force them into silence for the Palestinians. Bring water and food to the people on strike and on your lunch break if you can't join them yourselves. There are events planned for every hour of the day today, so as well as all week. Like, the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights is planning another shutdown event December 16th. I know New York, they are doing an event, I think, on the 14th. There are events all week, so even if you can't strike today, you can still protest for Palestine. If you're looking for ways to help, check out the following organizations on whatever social media platforms you're on. The Palestinian Youth Movement, Jewish Voices for Peace, Never Again Chicago, or just Never Again, the National Group. Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, Gaza is Palestine, Democrat Socialists of America, and the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. We have to keep up the pressure, we have to keep talking about Palestine, even though it seems hopeless, even if you're feeling fatigued, even if it's, like, too much, and I can understand that, the grief is just too fucking much, but we can't stop, because the Palestinians don't have a choice. They still have to live in that nightmare, and they are being surrounded on all sides. They need us to continue speaking out, they need us to remember who supported this, not just 3 months from now, 6 months from now, not just next year, but forever. Everyone who supported this genocide has to be held accountable any way we can. So please keep talking about Palestine, join many of the protests, as many protests as you can, keep calling your representatives, even if it seems hopeless, make sure that they know that you know they support genocide, and make sure that they know that you are not going to vote for them again. You're not going to vote for them, you're not going to vote for their party, you're going to F it. And don't let anyone tell you, well, you know, if you don't vote for Biden, you vote for Trump. Bullshit, because Biden doesn't have to run. Right, there's no law that says he has to run. The Democrats put up any other candidate. Second, if they really cared about democracy, they wouldn't be supporting a genocide. We have one asset at this point, Joe. Stop supporting the genocide. You can't even do that. So fuck them. And since this will be the last episode, I hope for those who celebrate Christmas, I hope you have a very happy Christmas. For everyone else, I hope you enjoy the end of the year. I hope you enjoy the weather. And I hope that you keep protesting for Palestine, but also take some time for yourself if you have to. Take some time with your family, love them, cherish them, and be ready to continue the fight starting 2024. And now, it's time to discuss Comyn na Bonn during the Irish Civil War. Last episode, we talked about how the Irish Civil War affected the daily lives of Irish women. Despite the many challenges facing them, women were not passive observers of the Irish War of Independence or the Irish Civil War. Many women joined Comyn na Bonn, a nationalist organization that worked closely with Sinn Féin and the IRA to achieve an independent Ireland. Comyn na Bonn would be the first organization to reject the treaty and provide the anti-treaty side its iron and stubborn core. Part 1. Comyn na Bonn during the Irish War for Independence. Comyn na Bonn was created in 1914 to serve as a nationalist organization for women. It would later be associated as an auxiliary unit for the Irish Volunteers and then Sinn Féin. They were rarely acknowledged as an independent movement, which is why some feminists, like Hannah Shea Skeffington, would never be a member of Comyn na Bonn. And most of the women accepted that their role in the revolution was to support the actions of the IRA and Sinn Féin via the Dáil. The group started as a nationalist group for all women, but as home rule polarized Irish society, Comyn na Bonn drifted to a more militant stance, just like the Irish Volunteers at the time. They lost several members through this evolution, but their goal became stronger and clearer. Even though they were a small group, they took their drilling and training very seriously. A member of Comyn na Bonn would learn basic gun safety, care, and how to fire one, how to march and drill, and how to apply first aid. When they weren't training, they were traveling all over the country raising funds for the cause. They collected money through house visits, church collections, and by hosting dances and concerts. The dance and concerts drew the youth of Ireland, allowing Comyn na Bonn to introduce them to nationalist rhetoric and goals. During the war itself, Comyn na Bonn served in a supportive but vital role. Many served as spies, scouts, messengers, smugglers, and keepers of the IRA's hideouts. When the IRA needed a place to hide, they would often reach out to a Comyn na Bonn member they knew and ask them to find a safe house. They trusted the woman's recommendation because she was often known to them, but also because she was a member of Comyn na Bonn. The women of Comyn na Bonn were successful as spies, smugglers, and keepers of important documents because of the British Army's sexism. Often, the woman in the safe house would use her charms to delay the British soldiers while an IRA member escaped, use their own persons to hide documents, and use their sex to shame the British soldiers of their rough treatment of them. Oftentimes, women who worked in key positions in the British apparatus were invisible to their British employers and were thus able to smuggle documents or even delay important messages between British barracks, buying the IRA forces time to either plan a counterattack or escape. Michael Collins took advantage of the invisibility of women to gather his intelligence. He even trolled some of his trusted agents to stop attending Comyn na Bonn events so they wouldn't draw attention to themselves. If the women weren't in Ireland, they were abroad, usually in the United States, speaking, campaigning, and fundraising. Comyn na Bonn women weren't directly on the front line, but they still ran the same kind of risks because they were often dealing directly with the British soldiers. They were the ones who had to deal with frequent house raids, abuse, and the perpetual fear of their partners being arrested and what that would mean for the family. On top of that, they had to deal with the misogyny and sexism of certain IRA officers and Sinn Féin members. Some men were outright very dismissive of Comyn na Bonn's contribution, believing that it was only natural for women to serve a supportive role and that they were doing no more than their regular quote-unquote womanly duties. Other men were initially skeptical and slowly softened their opinions once the women proved themselves. Others trusted them right away and relied heavily on them. But even these men didn't stop to think of what Irish women wanted, needed, and hoped would be achieved with independence. It was one thing to acknowledge a woman was resourceful and useful, another to consider her to be a true equal, with an equal right to determine the future of Ireland. While several Comyn na Bonn records detail some of these sexist encounters, the women remained dedicated to the nationalist cause and did all they could to assist the IRA and Sinn Féin. By the time the Irish War of Independence ended with a truce, 50 Irish people had been jailed during the war, including several Comyn na Bonn women, and many others experienced domestic raids and also physical and sexual violence at the hands of British forces. Comyn na Bonn believed this dedication had earned them the right to help shape Ireland's future. Instead, they weren't even invited to send a delegate to negotiate with the British Empire. The only women who traveled were Griffith, Collins, and the others were secretaries. The Irish men's complete ignorance and or disregard of their women counterparts could not have been clearer. Part 2. Comyn na Bonn and the Treaty. The Comyn na Bonn executive held a meeting in January and decided to reject the treaty. They were the first organization to do so. They publicly announced their position stating, quote, "The executive of Comyn na Bonn reaffirms their allegiance to the Irish Republic and therefore cannot support the articles of the treaty signed in London. Quote is from Paul McCarthy's book, Coming to Bond and the Irish Revolution, page 177. However, the executive had not asked its many branches how they felt about the treaty, and so another convention was held on February 5, 1922. During the meeting, Jenny Weiss Powers and Min Mulcahy, formerly Min Ryan, asked the group to support the treaty, or at least wait until Sinn Féin and the IRA decided how they felt. Mary McSweeney was dismissive, claiming that she didn't need to wait to see what the men would decide. This is a very different sentiment from when the organization was first created and decided to be an auxiliary of Sinn Féin. This time, women were deciding first and for themselves. Even though women like Mary McSweeney, Constance Markievicz, and others were passionate and vehement opponents of the treaty, they didn't represent many Common of Bond members. Women like Jenny Weiss Powers, who founded Common of Bond, and Min Mulcahy, left Common of Bond and went pro-treaty. Jenny Weiss Powers would create Common na Shersha, a pro-treaty organization, to counter Common of Bond's influence. Common na Shersha was strongest in Dublin and Cork, with branches in Wexford, Wicklow, Monaghan, Kilkenny, Tipperary, Leitrim, Sligo, Meath, and Kildare. They organized dances, concerts, travel hostels, and railway canteens for the National Army, while also supplying comforts like cigars, fruit, and playing cards to the wounded. They also, far more quietly and less publicly, served as searchers in the prisons, searching the bodies of their former comrades and friends when they were interned. Some anti-treaty women called Common na Shersha the Common na Searchers. The anti-treaty IRA considered Common na Shersha enough of a threat to warrant recording who was involved in tailing some of its members. The anti-treaty IRA burnt down Jenny Weiss Powers' house in December 1922 and her restaurant in February 1923. They would also throw a bomb in Common na Shersha's headquarters in 1923. In the countryside, especially in Cork, the anti-treaty IRA targeted Free State women, burning their abodes, shaving their heads, and harassing them. Many women simply left politics and the national cause once Common na Bond went anti-treaty. They either left to care for their families, to try and rebuild their lives in a new Irish state, or simply because they didn't believe enough in either cause to willingly fight against their friends, family members, and neighbors. This reduced the total number of branches and members of Common na Bond during the Irish Civil War, and hardened Common na Bond's resolve to resist the Free State government at all costs. During the treaty debate, women TDs, many of whom were Common na Bond members, provided a powerful and furious assault on the treaty and the pro-treaty members of the Dáil. When they weren't speaking, Constance Markievicz and Mary McSweeney frequently interrupted pro-treaty speakers with questions and comments. Other women used their loss of husbands, brothers, and sons to justify their interest and right in not just opposing the treaty, but being involved in shaping Ireland's future. Many pro-treaty TDs accused the women TDs of being overly emotional and angry, allowing their own sense of loss to blind them to the greater good, quote-unquote, greater good of Ireland. Fiona Lynch argued that, "Now we have a great deal of emotion here and a great deal of emotional speeches about the dead. I say for myself, the bones of the dead have been rattled indecently in the face of this assembly." Quote is from Claire Mitchin's article, Women of Character. Even though Margaret Pierce and Kathleen Clark mentioned their dead sons and husbands in their speeches against the treaty, others like Mary McSweeney, who spoke for 4 hours straight, and Constance Markievicz didn't mention the dead, focusing on the specific reasons why the treaty was unacceptable, with Constance providing a labor perspective. In fact, the women were offended by the accusation of using the dead for their own aims, with Kathleen O'Callaghan stating that the women of An Dáil are women of character and they will vote for principle, not for expediency. And Dr. Ada English argued that she had, quote, "no dead men to throw in my teeth as a reason for holding the opinions I hold." Both quotes are from Claire McGinney's article, Women of Character. In addition to speaking against the treaty in the Dáil, members of Common na Bond also campaigned to support Kathleen O'Callaghan's motion to expand the electorate by allowing women over 21 to vote. Currently, only women with property and were over 30 could vote. Even though the pro-treaty TDs argued that this was just another attempt to derail the treaty, women on all political spectrums felt this was their natural right. Women had played an important role in fighting for Ireland's independence. It was only right and fair, and promised in the Easter Proclamation, that all women would have the same opportunities as men to shape their government and futures. O'Callaghan challenged the pro-treaty TDs, asking why were they so afraid of expanding the electorate if they truly believed the treaty was supported by a majority of the Irish people. Arthur Griffith, a longtime supporter of women's right to vote, gravely disappointed all feminists when he refused to update the electoral register to include this wave of new voters, arguing that it would take too long to update, further jeopardizing Ireland's future. The general election was delayed anyway, as Collins and De Valera worked on a pact that would ensure that it would be a free election and to avoid further bloodshed. All six women TDs ran for re-election in the June 1922 general election, but only Mary McSweeney and Kathleen O'Callaghan won. Part 3, Cumann na Bán during the Irish Civil War. Cumann na Bán took traditionally masculine military roles during the Irish Civil War. They carried arms, served as quartermasters, ran to and fro in war zones, offered medical care, served as spies and messengers, and organized the collection and distribution of weapons. They organized safe houses and had to go on the run multiple times or end up in jail, where they would go on hunger strike to protest the Free State. They were also responsible for a lot of the anti-treaty IRA propaganda. For example, Elizabeth McGuire was quartermaster for the IRA's Dublin Brigade and was involved in 28 attacks against the Free State soldiers. Sheila Humphreys led an armed Cumann na Bán unit to free a wounded anti-treaty soldier from a Free State hospital. Sheila was also involved in the gun battle that ended with Ernie O'Malley's arrest. Laura Cunningham, a spy for the anti-treaty IRA, remembered her experiences with the Free State soldiers as, quote, "The IRA columns were now moving around the outskirts of Macroom, and with other members of Cumann na Bán, I was engaged in maintaining contact with them and reporting on the activities and movements of the Free State forces in the town. I managed to get through on a few occasions as I had disguised myself by wearing a Macroom hooded cloak, but eventually some local officers of the Free State forces who had been in the IRA before the truce suspected me, and I was informed that I would not be allowed to leave Macroom town." Quote is from Kyle McCarthy's book, Cumann na Bán and the Irish Revolution, page 201. Cumann na Bán took on the added responsibility of providing the military escort and honors during the funeral of several anti-treaty officers. Cumann na Bán member Eileen McGrain remembers Harry Boland's funeral as, quote, "At the funeral, Cumann na Bán took charge as the men did not appear. Sheila Humphreys and I were in charge and walked at the head of the cortege to Glasnevin. There were several bands playing the Dead March on the route. It was very solemn and sad and left on me an unforgettable impression." End quote is from Kyle McCarthy's book, Cumann na Bán and the Irish Revolution, page 200. Not only did Cumann na Bán members serve as military escort for Cathal Brodar's funeral per his wife's request, they also warned off any pro-treaty supporters who thought about attending the funeral. The anti-treaty IRA members who weren't diehard feminists themselves noticed and appreciated the commitment of Cumann na Bán and seemed less threatened than the pro-treaty side by the woman's involvement. Ernie O'Malley, an anti-treaty IRA member, wrote, quote, "During the Tan War, the girls had always helped, but they never had sufficient status. Now they were our comrades, loyal, willing, and incorruptible comrades.
Indefatigable.
They put the men to shame by their individual zeal and initiative." End quote is from
Marianne Jelena Velulis.
The Making of Inequality, page 43. It is doubtful if this sentiment would have survived an anti-treaty victory, or if Irish women's needs would have been addressed by an anti-treaty republic. Given their more prominent role during the Irish Civil War, it's not surprising that Cumann na Bán fatalities doubled their Irish War of Independence numbers. Mary Hartney was the first Cumann na Bán casualty of war. She died on August 4th, 1922, while providing first aid to anti-treaty soldiers during an artillery bombardment. The second Cumann na Bán victim was Lily Bennett. She was attending a rally hosted by the Republican Prisoners' Defense Committee when the Free State soldiers opened fire, wounding 7 people, including Lily. She would die from her wounds on November 18th, 1922. Margaret Doone died during a Free State reprisal. On April 8th, 1923, a Free State soldier was wounded during a gunfight. 10 minutes after the gunfight, that soldier's captain spotted Margaret Doone and another anti-treaty IRA member and shot at them, killing Margaret. The local anti-treaty IRA men risked arrest and execution to provide the military escort for her funeral. Annie Nan Hogan was the final casualty. She had organized safe houses during the Irish War of Independence, so she was well known amongst both the anti-treaty IRA and the Free State soldiers. Late in 1922, several anti-treaty prisoners tried to escape Limerick jail by digging a tunnel. The escape plot was betrayed, and on the night of the attempted escape, the Free State soldiers arrested several Cumnabon women waiting outside the prison, including Nan Hogan. She was sent to Comingham Jail and went on hunger strike on March 1923, demanding better conditions and POW status. The hunger strike was eventually called off when it was clear the Free State government wouldn't budge, but the damage had already been done for Nan. She was released in September 23 and died a short time later, her friends and family believing the hunger strike and the conditions of Comingham killed her. The Irish Free State used Cumnabon's heavy involvement as a way to cast them as crazed, passionate witches who both instigated extremism and threatened anti-treaty masculinity. They weren't quote-unquote proper Irish women, but bloodthirsty hags and banshees. They belittled women who were related to national heroes like Mary McSweeney and Margaret Pierce, calling them shrill, emotional, and bitter, accusing them of threatening Ireland's future for quote-unquote personal reasons, and for quote-unquote being blinded by their grief. P.S. O'Hagerty, who sounds like an ass, wrote that Dublin was full of quote-unquote hysterical women who were unlovely, destructive-minded, arid begetters of violence. He blamed them in particular for the bitterness and ferocity of this civil war. This hatred and villainization of women would bode ill for them after the Civil War, and the Cosgrave administration was able to let its misogyny hang out without reservations. The pro-treaty side chose to completely ignore the very real concern women had about losing their equality and their rights. Yes, the women were fighting for a republic, because the republic was the only entity that explicitly granted equality to everyone. Relying on the 1916 proclamation, many anti-treaty women argued that they were rejecting a British-sponsored puppet government that was rejecting all aspects of the republic, including the all-important equality clause. The Irish Civil War wasn't just a fight over semantics or different understandings of republic versus state, total freedom versus guided, or stage freedom. For many women, it was a literal fight for their rights and their lives. Unfortunately, the Cosgrave and De Valera administrations only justified their worst fears. Thank you for listening. I hope you found this episode insightful. You can listen to my full catalog on Spotify, iTunes, and my website, www.samswarroom.com. Please join my Patreon at www.patreon.com/AOAwarfare to keep up to date on all my projects. Until next time, wear a mask, organize with your community, demand a ceasefire in Gaza, and stay safe.